Just call me. How many of you have said that? Just call me. Calls make a big difference. Depends what kind of call you receive, who it's from, what it's for. I remember experiences in my life, great joy at getting a certain call. Remember the very first job after graduating from social work in McGill and hearing that I had been chosen to be the social worker at this particular place. That call was a wonderful call. It's a great call. It's significant. And there are other stories like that. But there are also calls that destabilize us, that shatter us. I remember the call I received both when my father and mother died. That's the kind of call you don't like to get. Changes your life. Calls are significant. Such was the nature of the call that Jesus uttered to Simon Peter and to James and John in our gospel lesson today. It was an earth-shattering call, a life-changing call. That story is a kind of a fish story, but not really a fish story. Our young people this morning wanted to share their fish stories, and all of you have got fish stories. Even if you haven't fished, you've heard somebody, and you can elaborate on it. That's the nature of fish stories. They get, but the fish was so big, well, you know what happens to fish stories. This is a fish story that really gets enlarged and is more than about fish. There's some details in the particular story that help us realize some of the drama into which both Jesus entered and invited the people who were around. We often forget when we hear this story of the calling of those disciples, of the context. The context was Jesus speaking, teaching, preaching. It begins with Jesus on the shoreline in the morning, most likely. And there's a crowd. The crowd is so big that he cannot talk with them comfortably, possibly, audibly, sufficiently. And so he borrows some vacated boats and gets in a boat and pushes out a little bit so that he could speak to them. It was a great tool, great acoustical technique, for your voice carries very well off of water. And he spoke to the crowd. And it says, and when he finished speaking, he said to Simon. I'd like to think that this was a wonderful sermon illustration. I wish I could come up with some nice ones like that. Put out to the deep. Great big catch of fish. Wouldn't that be great, Barbara? Boy, I tell you, you'd remember that story. You'd remember that sermon if I came up with an illustration like that. I'd like to think that this is part and parcel of what Jesus was teaching the people. For we know in the life of Jesus that his understanding of God's mission and claim upon his life, his actions and his speaking and what he expected of those whom he called was all the same, a seamless symmetry of constancy and unity. He expected and lived and demonstrated. So what he was saying to the people was somehow part and parcel, I would like to believe, of what he invited Simon Peter and the other fishermen to do. But how do we understand this story, this particular call, and what is hidden inside of it in his relationship with them? We have some clues in the story. You would remember that they were washing their nets when Jesus came. Now, the people who heard this story at first in the first century would have known exactly what had happened. They were using trammel nets, a different type of net. They were made of linen, white linen, and they were very, very effective. They were light and therefore able to be cast very well with a few men. They were skilled at casting these nets, slightly weighted. But the problem is that because of their color, they would be seen by the fish in the day. So do you notice that detail of the story, that they had been fishing all night and nothing, because they fished at night? So the fish could not see the nets, and therefore they would be assured of a greater catch. In the day, the fish would see the nets. And so Jesus comes, they are washing their nets. That's a detail that's a very important one and fits with the story. And Jesus says to them, put out to the deep. Put out to the deep and cast your net. Now, these are experienced fishermen. We know that they're in business partnership together. James and John are partners with Peter. They have a fishing business, a modest one, because they would probably have to rent the boats. They may not have owned those boats. And we have a description of the boats just about 5 or 6 years ago. Archaeologists discovered in the Sea of Galilee, fairly well preserved in some silt, a boat from the first century, very similar to what they would have used. It was a fishing boat, deep and long and wide and used for fishing. And it gives us an idea of what kind of details are being described here, because in those days, what we know from anthropological comparisons is that people generally lived to about five, in terms of height, about 5'5". That was average height, fairly high, tall for people of that age and that time. And so the boats actually came up a little bit above that. So when they climbed in and it talks about the fish overflowing the boats, it's to try to give you a sense of the absolute abundance that was there. The symbol and the metaphor of the story is deep and full, more than they could do with, more than they had ever seen before. And don't you find it interesting that it is when they recognize and say to Jesus, "We have been fishing all night and nothing." It is often true that that is when we are more often susceptible to the call and the recruiting invitation of God. When we have expanded and expended all of our resources, all of our ideas, and all of our creativity, when we are stuck, we have hit a wall, we are no longer able to rely solely on our own capacity, and we realize our finitude, that we are finite. We recognize, indeed, perhaps our hearts and souls are open to another suggestion. And here comes Jesus into the midst of that and invites them to something greater. For it's not about how much fish. It's about what happens in their relationship with this Jesus. Notice that Simon in the story first recognizes the official title of Jesus. He was known as a rabbi in the neighborhood, and so he calls him master. But after this encounter, after this incredible experience of finding not only all this fish, but realizing somehow in that encounter with him, I would like to think that perhaps as the disciples sat there washing their nets, that they also were listening to what Jesus was saying to the people. For Jesus was preaching and teaching the people. The disciples were washing their nets. That somehow, perhaps for them, they saw the connection between what Jesus invited them to do and what happened. In the language and vocabulary indicative of perhaps a change in relationship between Peter and Jesus occurs. But then he says, "Get away from me." In fact, the Greek is very interesting. It says, "Get out of my neighborhood, for I am an unclean, I am a sinful man. Have nothing to do with me." There's something that happened in him. Some act of faith, for they had to push out in the day. If they look like fools, remember, the crowd is still there. This is all happening in front of everyone. Jesus tells them, go out, put out to the deep in the middle of the day with these white linen nets that the fish will see. How do they expect to catch any fish? Why would they do that and risk looking like fools? It's a good question, isn't it? Could it be that they, like we, sometimes have been all night doing our best? And still nothing. Nothing. 49%, according to Pew Forum research, 49% of Americans, I couldn't find the details for Canadians, 49% of Americans report, according to this survey, that they have had mystical experiences that they would call with the divine, not quite sure how to put into language. They've had encounters that they have not necessarily welcomed, or they have come unbidden. I suspect many people in Canada too are not that different from the United States. The interesting thing about the research is that far too often these mystical experiences, these experiences that come to people in various venues of their lives, don't happen in religious institutions. We have to ask ourselves, perhaps as communities of faith or even those who profess to be following Jesus, is there something that we're doing that we have become so accustomed to or that we are resistant to that is making us or our communities less open and vulnerable to these intrusions of God? I don't know. What I want to suggest, though, just briefly, three things that I believe prevent us from experiencing fully something of what Peter and the other disciples did at that moment. What sometimes inhibit and hamper these experiencing. The first is that we have a resistance to putting out to the deep. Most of us like to live our lives in the shallow end, where the little minnows will tickle our feet and things are safe. They are safe, but they are not fulfilling. They're safe, but they do not go to where our souls and our spirit and our lives are itching, our desire to discover our call and our purpose. Jesus knows and tells them, put out to the deep, because in the deep, it's in the deep that the increase happens. It's in the deep that we discover God. It's in the deep that faith begins to take over, not replace, but take over and go beyond our reason and our capacity. I remember when I was a little boy, there were four of us. I had a brother and two sisters. We would go to the beach in Barbados. I lived in Barbados. We grew up there when I was young. And when we would go, we had this great thing that we looked forward to. My dad was a strong swimmer, and he would take turns swimming way out into the ocean in the Caribbean Sea. And we'd sit on his back. I loved that. That was one of my favorite memories, my favorite things. And he'd be swimming. I'd say, go, Dad, go, Dad. I'm not doing any work, you know. He'd say, go, Dad, yeah, it's great. It's great. One of the things we used to do is bring a bottle out because you get seawater. It was used for medicinal purposes, but not near the shore, but way out. So when we got out to a certain part, we'd fill the bottle and come back in. My job was to hold the bottle. I was good at that. So we'd swim out, and then we'd talk about the purpose of being in the deep. You can't learn to swim unless you are in the deep. For in the deep, you begin to recognize you're not only trusting the laws of physics and the buoyancy of H2O, but it is symbolic. And use that as an illustration of how we are to trust what we have not constructed, what we have not made, but what has been provided for us. Push out into the deep for God's grace, God's love, God's mercy, God's forgiveness, God's direction, God's call is sufficient to hold us when we have been fishing all night, and then nothing. The second reason I think that we have trouble experiencing that deep commitment and that deep relationship with God is that I think too often we don't expect it. We don't expect it. Faith is about expectation. Hebrews defines faith as the substance of things hoped for. When you come here to worship Sunday after Sunday, when you go to work, when you have exchanges with the one you love, what do you expect? Is it same old, same old? Do you expect something great to happen, something possible beyond your dreams? Do you expect to be transformed? Do you expect to be chided? Do you expect to be loved? Do you expect to be forgiven? What is it that you expect? Largely, we have learned to minimize our expectations because we don't like being disappointed. We want to play it safe. And that carries over and bleeds over to our relationship with God. We do not expect to be made alive and to be picked up, shunted over to somewhere else and said, that's where you're supposed to be going. You have been missing it. Or to be confirmed in that direction. What do you expect when you encounter God? A number of years ago, I was representing the United Church in Geneva at an international conference on overcoming racism. And there were members there from all over the world, especially indigenous communities, talking about their experiences of exclusion and so forth. And there were some members from the European delegation and from England and so forth that were talking about how within our Christian faith now we don't really expect when we have dialogue, interfaith dialogue, to be converting people. We're just sharing respectfully and so forth with each other and so on and so on. There were members from India, from the Church of South India that were there, two members, and they were part of the Dalit people. The Dalits used to be formally called the Untouchables. And the Untouchables in Indian society, and part of, no, don't get me wrong, this is not the whole philosophy of Hinduism, but part of the Hinduism philosophy and so forth, consigned the Untouchables to a lot in life that was worse than animals. In fact, before the Constitution, some decades ago, Dalits could be killed. They were the ones who cleaned the toilets, did all of those menial tasks, and they were just not part of the karmic circle that was going to get them anywhere at all. That was their lot in life, and they were the dredge and dirt of society. Many, many years ago, when Christian missionaries went and they started to share the story of Jesus, Jesus' love of all people, but especially, we read this morning in the Psalm 138, that God looks with regard and fondness upon the lonely, the lowly, the marginalized, the oppressed, the poor. They heard stories of Jesus encountering those who were lepers and others. And they reported to that whole assembly that the Dalit people embraced this faith. They embraced this good news and this story because those people who shared it expected that God could do something. Only 2% of the population in India is Christian. 82% of that 2% are Dalit. It's not an accident. They saw the liberation and the empowerment that came from a story and an understanding of God who, through His Son, demonstrated a privileging of those who were thrown away by society. They expected. One of the problems in our difficulty in being, indeed, the ones who offer and throw the net wide is we don't expect anything. We just expect to get along nicely. But there is a transformative call in the story that helps us discover our purpose. Michelangelo said, when he spoke of his sculptures, that he did not create those beauty, arts of beauty. All he did was chip away and cut away what was preventing them from being what they already were. God has a purpose. You see, each of us is chosen. Each of us is called. It's not just me or Barbara or this person or that person. Each of us is chosen and called. The difficulty is that we fail to RSVP. We don't say, like Isaiah, after recognizing our unworthiness and our, in all humility, to say, here I am, send me. But we are called. And the last is that unfortunately, sometimes as churches and congregations and individuals, we think we know more than God about fishing and about life. God says, love your enemies, forgive, be merciful, be humble. But we're all about getting ahead. We're all about, I'm not giving them the satisfaction of forgiveness. They did that to me. Why should I do that? We think we know better than God how to live, only to discover how miserable we get, how unsatisfied our choices to resist the invitation of God's description and menu of how we ought to be with each other and in the world. When we resist that, we consign ourselves to misery. It is the lightning gift of the forgiveness and generosity, living abundantly and graciously and mercifully, recognizing with all humility that we are in receipt of a whole lot more than we give, that we live our lives indebted to those who create life for us and with us. So when we think we know more than God and live according to our own or the world's category of being, we resist those mystical experiences, those experiences of the call of Jesus to put out to the deep. And the Bible says, and they left all that they had and followed. Perhaps today the call comes. And just about now would be a wonderful illustration if somebody's cell phone went off. But maybe today the call. Oh, everybody's reaching for their phone. You know? It's okay, no, I'm kidding. The call of God to you and to me is to trust. Is to go deeply where we haven't gone before. Is to expect something miraculous, something transformative to happen in our relationship and trust of God. And it is to render the humility necessary to be in receipt of all that God generously and graciously wants to give us. Why? Because the world's well-being depends on it. The last thing I want to say is how misunderstood this notion about catching people You see, you and I are summoned and called and chosen and asked to go. But the word that is used about make you fishers of people, it's a very particular word. It's not the kind of fishing, and notice the net that's thrown out. It's not about hooks, as Melody was saying. It's about the net, and really the sense is to captivate, to capture, but to captivate people, to throw the net of God's love and draw people into a relationship with that. And the truth of the matter is not is the net is not something we use. We are the net. We are the net. So we throw our lives and our resources and our love and our humility and graciousness into the world and attract those who would come to the good news of the gospel. Whom shall I send?